Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as Pope Benedict prepares to visit Rome's Lutheran Church on Sunday, we find out more about his special relationship to this small but vibrant German-speaking community. And on the cusp of a new chapter in Northern Ireland's political history, hear from Britain's Minister of State for Belfast about the crucial role of the Church in the ongoing process of reconciliation between divided communities. On Sunday, Pope Benedict XVI is set to make a pastoral visit to the Evangelical Lutheran community here in Rome to pray and meet together with members of the largely German-speaking community there. At a Liturgy of the Word on Sunday afternoon, the Pope will be recalling another visit to the church over a quarter of a century ago, when his predecessor, John Paul II, also crossed Rome's city centre, the first pontiff to set foot inside a Lutheran church since the days of the Reformation. Since then, of course, much progress has been made in the official Lutheran-Roman Catholic dialogue, and Rome's Lutheran community now works closely with local Catholic churches and communities.
They are engaged in very many ecumenical relationships, not only with the Catholic Church, also with Orthodox churches, with the Anglican Church, and many others.
Monsignor Matthias Turk follows the dialogue with the Lutheran world for the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. I talked to him about the significance of this visit in the broader ecumenical context.
The Evangelical Lutheran parish here in Rome is a very active part of the local church, we can say, of those many Christians who live for a long time in this eternal city. So this visit strengthens and underlines the very good relationships we have on the level of the city of Rome with the Lutheran Church. These relationships normally take place on the level of the diocese, of course. The Diocese of Rome has a very engaged ecumenical program, but this time the Holy Father himself wanted to pay a visit in remembering the first visit of a pope more than 25 years ago by his beloved predecessor John Paul II in 1983.
That visit was a particularly historic occasion, wasn't it?
It was very significant because it went along with those other journeys of Pope John Paul II to, as we can say, predominantly Lutheran or Protestant countries, like his first visit to Germany and also his visit to the Scandinavian countries, which are predominantly Lutheran, and also to the United States. So this was an initiative on the level of his see, the city of Rome.
It was also the first time, though, that a pope had ever set foot in a Lutheran church since the Reformation, wasn't it?
As far as I can say here, I'm not the church historian par excellence, but I would say yes. And it showed a new brotherhood, a brotherhood rediscovered between Catholics and Lutherans that also had an eminent element on the liturgical level, on the level of worship, more than just being together in commissions and debates.
So how would you describe perhaps the impact of that visit over these past 25 years?
It was a starting point, and it helped very much to foster the relationships between Catholics and Lutherans on the worldwide level. Many others took the example from here and had common worship, common liturgies, until the present day, where we have a manifold ecumenical life throughout the year. But also the theological level has been strengthened, and we were able to produce a good number of dialogue documents that show how far our consensus has come, although there are still remaining differences that are also church dividing.
The most significant of those documents, of course, was the 1999 document, a Common Declaration on Justification. And, of course, the then Cardinal Ratzinger played a crucial role in that, didn't he?
At that time, he was prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, and in such a position, very much responsible for these questions of faith, which ecumenical questions always are. So with his help, we were able to finalize this document, even with this so-called official common statement and an annex, both texts that could clarify more the content and the meaning of the text of the Joint Declaration of Justification.
How much did Joseph Ratzinger's own background, his German culture, language, the shared background, how much did that, do you think, influence the success of that document?
It's one way to be able to study documents of Lutheran theology, and it's another way, another element, to live in such a country and have a personal experience from your lifetime how the relationship to Lutheran Church, to the Lutherans, are. So with this special background, he was very well prepared for these negotiations and had the best possibilities to engage himself very intensely. And regarding Germany as the country of the Reformation, it's a unique situation in the world, because in Germany you would have 50% of the Christians being Protestant and 50% Catholic, with a relationship to numbers that don't exist in such a special way in any other country of this world. So we are a born situation, so to speak, for an engaged and intense dialogue between the confessions.
Cardinal Ratzinger himself was also a frequent visitor, I understand, to the Lutheran Church here in Rome before he was elected to the See of Peter.
I remember very well his visit to the Lutheran Church, where he met at that time the president of the Evangelical Church in Germany, Bishop Huber, for a discussion, for a plenary discussion in the building of the church. And at that time, it was 1 year before the signing of the Joint Declaration, especially that question of justification was in the center of attention. And there were a good number of obstacles at that time to have been to overcome still. And Cardinal Ratzinger was very much engaged at that time, helping there. And with Huber in that evening, which was very informative for everybody, but also helpful for to continue the process that finally led to the signature of the Joint Declaration. So it was a meaningful step towards that document that took place here in the Roman Lutheran parish.
Cardinal Ratzinger also has a particular passion for the music, doesn't he, I believe, from the Lutheran tradition?
Oh, I'm sure also in his coming visit now he will very much enjoy the beautiful organ music the Lutheran Church has, a very good organist there. And also we have to confess that our musical tradition, the rich tradition of hymns in liturgy, mostly come from a Lutheran tradition, because in the Catholic tradition that was not so common for every member of the parish to join in such hymns like we have today.
Can we hope for any kind of breakthrough, perhaps, any kind of historical significance then for this visit?
Everybody is always hoping for breakthroughs, so do we. But our daily work consists in moving on step by step. And if you don't want to fall down or come to the slippery ground, you better prepare your next step very precisely. And you do that together with your ecumenical partner, so you feel that you go together in a joined direction, and that direction needs to be full visible unity and nothing less.
Monsignor Matthias Turki is an official of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Rome's Lutheran community numbers around 350 faithful, the majority of whom are living in mixed marriage families with Catholic partners or children. A very practical ecumenical challenge that their pastor, Reverend Jens Martin Kruse, deals with on a daily basis.
I'm here since August 2008.
He'll be on hand on Sunday to welcome Pope Benedict and to show him something of the vibrant parish life that has developed over the two centuries since Lutherans first began to worship here in the Eternal City.
Yes, we have a lot of groups, from the children to the adults. We work with the poor people. We have a lot of concerts. We make journeys for the members of our parish. I think it's very busy, our parish life.
It's also just one of, I believe, 14 different Lutheran communities throughout Italy.
Yes, we are very small in Italy. 14 small parishes, communities. We are, I think, in Italy, not more than 5,000 or 6,000 members of this church.
So what is the significance then? How important is this visit for you?
For us, it's a great pleasure that we can celebrate our worship together with the Pope. And I think that's the most important thing that we Christians can do, to celebrate worships together.
The Lutheran Church here already had a visit by Pope John Paul II, didn't it, back in 1983. And I believe that was the first time a Pope had ever been to a Lutheran church. Will this be perhaps remembered during this current visit?
It's right that it was the first visit of a Pope at the Lutheran Church. And I think we will remind of this, because our invitation to the Pope Benedict we have made in memory of 25 years ago of this visit of the Pope John Paul.
How significant was that, do you think, in the history of the ecumenical journey?
I think it was a great symbol. It was also a worship of the parish, of the community, but it has a significance for all the Christians, that the Lutherans and the Catholics and the other could celebrate worships together.
Many of your parishioners here will be in situations of mixed marriages with Catholics. I imagine this presents a number of challenges as well, doesn't it?
That's right. From the couples, we have this the problems of the ecumenical life in our parish every day. And that's the beginning for our ecumenical work. For them, it's often a great problem to decide where we go to the worship on Sunday, where we do the baptism of the child, the marriages. And so it's a part of my work to speak with these couples, to find solutions with Catholics, colleagues. For them, it's a great problem. And at Rome, not every Catholic colleague has an experience on this field, so we have to explain the problems. For my work as a referent of this church, it's one of the main topics in the ecumenical discourse at Rome.
What about the work that you do beyond that with the other pastors, the other leaders of the churches here in Rome? How much is that an important part of your work?
It's a great part, this ecumenical work. For example, we have very good relationships with all the churches around our church. We are a member of this convent Churches Together at Rome, and we have a lot of relationships to other Catholic churches, to parishes, to the movements. Sant'Egidio Focolarini, and also to the Vatican. And often it's one of the topics is the question how we can handle this problem with the mixed couples.
Does it make any difference to you having a German Pope now, the ability to share the same language, perhaps the same culture?
It's an interesting question. I think it makes no difference. Perhaps it's a little bit easier that we can speak the same language, that we have the same tradition, we know each other very well, and I hope that also for the Pope it's a good visit, a good day with us, because also for him there are not many possibilities to celebrate a worship in German, and so we're looking forward with a great pleasure to this day, and I hope that the Pope feel it. Let's hear a warm welcome for him.
Thanks there to Reverend Jens Martin Kruse, pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Parish here in Rome. Northern Ireland on the cusp of a new chapter in its political history. That was the headline of an article in the Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano recently, just days ahead of a crucial vote in the Northern Ireland Assembly over the transfer of policing and criminal justice powers from London to Belfast. On Tuesday, Republican and Unionist lawmakers voted in favour of this latest decisive step on the road to full devolution of power to the Northern Ireland Assembly, a process which began with the so-called Good Friday Agreement back in 1998. The vote now opens the way for a full transfer of powers on April the 12th this year, a move that is strongly supported by the British, Irish and American governments. Among those who hailed this vote as a watershed in the history of the Northern Ireland peace process is Paul Goggins, a member of the British Parliament and Minister of State for Northern Ireland. Last week he was here in Rome talking with top Vatican officials to bring them up to date on this final stage of the devolution process. In between meetings, he found time to drop into our studios and tell us more about his hopes for the future of the country and the role of the church in the ongoing process of reconciliation between divided communities.
The British government has always appreciated the interest and support of the Vatican in the pursuit of peace in Northern Ireland. This goes back over many, many years. And the Vatican and the Pope himself has always been outspoken in affirming the peace process, and indeed in speaking out when there is violence and conflict. And even as recently as a year ago, the Pope made clear his views about the attacks on the police officer and the soldiers who were murdered just a year ago. Therefore, we felt it was important to come back and update senior people in the Vatican about the progress that's been made on the political front, particularly over recent months, and some of the things that may happen in the very near future. So it's really by way of an update to a very long-term partner and supporter of the peace process in Northern Ireland.
You mentioned those attacks a year ago. They were seen as quite a serious setback, and yet you're quite optimistic at the moment, aren't you?
I am optimistic about the politics in Northern Ireland because we've come a long way in recent years. When I was last here, we were preparing for the possibility of the first stage of devolution. That happened in May 2007, and we now stand ready in the coming days and weeks to complete devolution and to hand over the powers of policing and also over the criminal justice system. This will be an enormous step, really the final piece in the jigsaw. But there is still a group of people, a small group of people in Northern Ireland who don't share that peaceful vision, that political progress. They want to undermine it by continuing to attack particularly police officers. So a year ago, we witnessed those three murders of the soldiers and the police officer. More recently, there was a car bomb attack in Newry. In the new year, there was an attack on a police officer with an undercar booby trap, which very, very badly injured the officer. He's still alive, but very badly hurt. So we know that the intent is still there from this small minority of people. We have to take that seriously. But I think the overall message from Northern Ireland is that politics is working, politics is winning, and is giving the people there real hope for the future.
Talking about the political process, why is, first of all, this handover of police and justice so crucial? You call it the last part of the puzzle.
It was always seen as the most challenging bit of devolution. It was challenging enough to get to a point where the local politicians would take on responsibility for hospitals, for schools, and for all the other aspects of public service and public administration. But to take over responsibility for the criminal law, for the wider criminal justice system, for the police service, this was a very big step. And of course, people from the unionist community asked some very hard questions of people from the Republican community about how serious they were in their support of the police. And those questions have been answered over recent years. Sinn Féin have signed up to full support for policing. They sit on the policing board. They're now fully part of government. And indeed, whenever there is an attack on a police officer or any other attack, they are straight out to condemn and to appeal to people to come forward. So we now have a situation where there's confidence in policing right across the community. And it's because of that that both the main parties have now reached an agreement to move forward to the completion of devolution.
You say you're confident and optimistic, and yet it was just a few weeks ago in January that the British and the Irish prime ministers had to step in at the last moment to save the breakdown of talks between Sinn Féin and the unionists. Yeah, isn't it a bit early for this optimism?
There was a real logjam in the Assembly because Sinn Féin wanted to press ahead with the devolution of policing and justice powers, and the unionists, the Democratic Unionist Party, who are the main unionist party, were reluctant. And there was a real sense that we'd got to an impasse, and the British Prime Minister and the Irish Taoiseach came in jointly to Northern Ireland and said, we really have to thrash this out. We have to reach an agreement so that we can get government working again. And what followed was 10 days and 10 long nights of negotiation, which I was personally involved in, the outcome of which was an agreement between the two main parties, supported by the governments. And since then, a considerable amount of work has gone on to work through the consequences of that agreement. I suppose my optimism about Northern Ireland is rooted in my experience now over nearly 4 years as a minister there, that things can and do always go wrong. But in the end, the politics are made to work. And that's why I remain optimistic that people will not let this opportunity pass by. They will grasp it and they will move on to the next stage.
What about the difficulties presented by the annual parades? They continue to be a contentious issue, don't they, year in, year out?
Well, there are thousands of parades in Northern Ireland every year, and most of them are not contentious. Most of them pass off peacefully. But a small number are still contentious, particularly where the Orange Order want to parade through an area which is seen as a nationalist area. And there are tensions when that happens. And it's clear to us that there has to be a better way, a more sustainable way of trying to resolve these tensions. We've had the Parades Commission over recent years, and it's done an excellent job in resolving most of these difficulties. But there are still a number of parades that are outstanding. And what the parties agreed at Hillsborough in the talks that we had earlier in the year was to try and find a new way of bringing communities together, getting mediation, getting a solution, and finding a new system for resolving any outstanding disputes. And it's very much in the hands now of the local parties to work this through so that we have a new system. But it is quite clear that we have to diffuse that tension around those few parades that are still contentious, because there's always the possibility of violence. There's always the possibility of community breakdown around those parades. And everybody wants to see a peaceful solution. The good thing now is that rather than central government imposing a solution, the parties themselves are in discussion and negotiation about a different way of doing it. And a homegrown solution, of course, is always the best.
You're talking about the vital role of the church in this work of reconciliation within the communities. That continues, doesn't it? Although, albeit a very different role from the one it played during the Troubles.
The role of the church is of enormous importance. We had the funeral in January of Cardinal Cathal Daly, a man who was loved by the people of Northern Ireland, but a man who, diminutive in physical stature, stood up against the men of violence through the years that he led the church in Northern Ireland. And his leadership is deeply appreciated even today. But at his funeral were people from all the Christian denominations because they recognised that they needed to speak and act together with one voice. And that happens today. A year ago, when the attacks on the soldiers and the police officer took place, there was a pastoral letter which was written by all the main church leaders that was read out in all the churches right across Northern Ireland, the same letter in every church. And I think that is the spirit now in which the churches operate, need to break down barriers and work together. And I think also the words of encouragement which the church leaders give to the politicians to keep on with the process, to keep moving forwards, are really valued by the politicians there, and I think have a real influence for the better in Northern Ireland.
What kind of projects, have you seen any grassroots work that really is making a difference across the divided communities?
There is a very rich and vibrant voluntary sector in Northern Ireland, many projects which are church-based, reaching out to people in need right across the community. I think, though, we all recognise that there is a need to do more to bring communities together. Whilst we've been through the peace process, people have handed over their weapons, we now have a political settlement, which hopefully will mean the completion of devolution. But to actually transform communities, to change the mindset, to move on from sectarian divide to a unified society, that's a task that will take many, many more years. And so civil society, the churches, all aspects of society need to engage in that task in a more vigorous way, perhaps even than they've been able to in the past. That will really cement the social cohesion which society needs.
What about the problems of investment in Northern Ireland?
It's a very important question. Of course, we've been through this terrible economic downturn, which has been a global phenomenon. So every country across the world has faced difficult questions in relation to public finances, investment and so on. But there are huge opportunities ahead for Northern Ireland if they get this right and if they show that they're up for self-governance in a responsible way. We've had the promise from Hillary Clinton of an investment conference later in the year in the United States where senior investors will gather together to talk about how they can help to put the investment in that will bring the economic benefits for the long term in Northern Ireland. There are so many willing people across the globe who want to help Northern Ireland and who are prepared to invest there. But of course, they're also business people and they're not going to invest in a place that's riven with conflict and violence. So they have to have that real sense of confidence that the politicians are taking control and that the peace is something that's sustainable and long-lasting. But I think that friendship that Northern Ireland has in America and elsewhere will bear real fruit across the months to come and indeed in the years to come.
Thanks there to Paul Goggins, Britain's Minister of State for Northern Ireland. And finally, at his general audience this Wednesday, Pope Benedict also expressed his hopes for the consolidation of peace in Northern Ireland. As Emma McCarthy reports, the Pope also prayed for all the victims of violent clashes in Nigeria and for those affected by the recent earthquake in Turkey.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, comincio con un appello.
Violence does not solve conflicts, but only increase the tragic consequences of conflict. This was Pope Benedict's call Wednesday as he evoked the weekend massacre in Plateau State, Nigeria, where an estimated 500 people were killed, even defenceless children. The horrific killings were the latest attacks in an ongoing inter-ethnic conflict that has wrought death and destruction on both the Christian and Muslim population.
Sono profondamente vicino alle persone.
I appeal, said Pope Benedict, to all those who have civilian and religious authority in the country to strive for security and the peaceful coexistence of all people. Finally, he said, I express my closeness to the pastors and faithful, and I pray that Nigerians, strong and firm in hope, be authentic witnesses of reconciliation.
Siano autentici testimoni di riconciliazione.
Finally, in greeting pilgrims in various languages, the Holy Father spoke of those affected by a recent earthquake in Turkey, offering his prayers for the victims and their families, and in English, welcomed progress in the political process in Northern Ireland.
The developments taking place in Northern Ireland in these days are a promising sign of hope, and I pray that they will help to consolidate the future of peace desired by all.
Thanks there to my colleague Emma McCarthy, and that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.